Kathleen Laval. You're a roving reporter for the Society of Neurolinguistic Programming. Every month, we're going to have a featured trainer from around the world. But we'd like to start this off with a very, very special guest, Dr. Richard Bandler. Hello, Richard.
Hello, Kathleen.
How are you today?
I'm okay.
Some of the things that we'd like to, we get a lot of questions about when we get people on the phone. The first question they always ask is, where did you come up with the name neurolinguistic programming?
Actually, it was from the floor of my car. I used to be in California when you got pulled over by the police. The thing they had you fill out has your name, your address, and what you did for a living. And I'd spent the day up at a hospital in Northern California. And during the day, a doctor had to ask me, he said, what exactly do you do? And we used to call the name of the techniques we developed a metamodel, but to say you're a metamodelist doesn't sound very good. And so when the policeman said, what's your profession? I looked down on the floor of the car, and there was a neurology book, and there was a linguistics textbook, and there was a programming manual to a PDP 1134A, which is a DEC computer, back in the days when they had flashing lights and floppy disks that were 2.5 feet across, RKO5s. But I looked at him and I just took part of each word and I went, neuro-linguistic programmer. And I thought, that comes trippingly off the tongue. Originally, though, everybody hated the name. They said, why don't you come up with something simple or that people would understand? And I used to like to look at a psychologist and go, like, you know, a simple, comprehensible word like id. But anyway, it to me was the most descriptive thing. We use language as a tool to educate people based on the structure of what they're doing, which is the linguistic portion of things, so that they can build good programs inside their head. You know, part of my job originally was to redesign computer programs so they ran more efficiently, used less space, and got the job done, which was the hard part. And that's very much similar to what I've done in the fields of communication and helping people out of difficulties, which is, to me, an educational process, not a therapeutic process.
You've done so many things in your fields of study. You work with optical and holography research and talented musician as well. What's the driving force behind staying with NLP all these years?
Well, one of the nice things about founding your own field is that you can't be wrong. Being a neurolinguistic programmer pretty much means it's the only field which is really metadisciplinary other than mathematics. And it has an algebraic mathematical foundation to it as well. But most fields are separated from knowledge. And NLP is really something which combines knowledge. The way in which architects think about bridges is the way in which we think about making permanent changes. Just like they don't want bridges to fall apart, I don't want the changes I make to people to fall apart. And it's allowed me to be able to work still as a scientist. I still work as a chemist. I still work with advanced systems planning and corporations to help them design new things. A lot of scientists, when they get stuck, call me on the phone, and I can ask them questions just like I can with anybody else to help them to get beyond it. To me, all the things that I've done are both about having personal freedom and getting other people to do it as well. You know, when I made up the field of NLP as the field of design human engineering and the other things I've done, to me, the major thrust is to be able to function wherever you want to. You know, I've studied everything from gurus in India, you know, to shamans in the jungle and American Indians and psychotherapists, but I've also studied engineers and scientists and people like Linus Pauling to find out how to get your brain to work better. The better your brain works, the more freedom you have as a human being.
We're going to be featuring a lot of different NLP trainers from around the world in the rest of the series. I ask you, what do you think really makes a good NLP trainer? What kind of attributes do you look for in someone who's going to be training NLP?
Well, you know, it's a difficult question. I mean, the first thing I look is, do they have good training themselves? you know, that there are many people that anoint themselves trainers, and I find that disgusting. It, to me, I'm always looking for people that have a wide range of flexibility and some understanding. I'm sitting here with you and with Eric Robbie. Eric was, as far as I was concerned, is a very different person than me. He doesn't try to be like me, but what makes him a really great trainer is that he thinks about what he's doing, and he cares about the quality of the work that he does. Eric has always kept himself abreast of everything that's going on in the field. He doesn't just take one little piece and try to be an expert in a small pond. To me, an expert is an ex as a has-been, and a spurt is a drip under pressure. When people specialize too much, that's the opposite of NLP. That, to me, it's not that you fixate on one technique or another technique or one domain. It's that you realize the broader your knowledge is, the more you understand about neurology, the more you understand about chemistry, the more you understand about medicine, the more you understand about rocket science and astrophotography and all of these things, the more you're really studying how people think about things. And the person who can successfully design a rocket ship to go to the moon is using his brain in a way that certainly produces more freedom than somebody that, you know, is only going to drive Fords. You know, I met people that go, I won't drive any other car but a Ford. And, you know, if that's where you limit yourself, that's where you limit yourself. And to me, I'm not looking for people, you know, who have limits, but people that expand limits. And, you know, of course, that means they can control their voice tone, their everything else. But it also means that they have an inquiring mind, not the one that wants to know smut like the National Enquirer, but one that inquires into what makes it possible for human beings to get further than each one is. And this means that you have to have an interest in people, and you have to believe in them more than they believe in themselves. And also, I don't like people who are pompous asses, and too many people who anoint themselves NLP trainers turn into pompous asses, and, you know, they think that being a trainer is about being admired, and it's not. It's about a lot of hard work and a lot of dedication and the more experience. Eric has been doing this for years. You've been doing this for years. I certainly have been doing it longer than anyone because I've made it up. And until I die, it's going to stay that way. And as you know, I'm pretty hard to kill.
Yes, we know that.
Although they did do it on the internet. May 12th, I died, according to the internet. But, you know, once again, I'm resurrected and back.
We use a lot of music in the seminars, and I know you enjoy playing music as well. Can you tell us a little bit about how music interfaces with seminars and learning?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, you know, if you watched a movie and it had no background music, you know, it would take a lot of the pizzazz out of it. And being able, human beings are like big giant tape recorders. They record everything they hear, but if it all sounds the same, then it's hard for them to make distinctions about it. It's important for human beings to be able to separate things out. And, you know, I use lots of sounds, you know, fanfares of trumpets, and it's very hard to be depressed with big fanfares of trumpets going on. And also, we use a lot of waveform resonance patterns, which literally vibrate the brain into one state and in another. Most of those are subsonic, so people are not conscious of them. I'm sure whales could discuss them, but it doesn't change the fact that what hits the surface of the skin of human beings influences them. And a lot of what I try to do is teach people to be aware of their output channels so they know what voice tone they're using, whether their inflection is going up or down, so that they know the difference between questions and commands and statements, so that by focusing people's attention on the rhythm of music, it helps them to speak. And when you trance people, certainly using waveform resonances with deep alpha patterns is going to be useful. This is why I just finished designing another light sound machine. And in the next couple of months, I'm going to go in the recording studio again and make another set of the personal enhancement series, designed not just to assist people in making changes, but to use the patterns of lights and the patterns of sound, subsonics, so that they can change their state radically and quickly. Because one of the things that's obvious to me is that most of the people I meet are far too tense. And in this planet right now, I think stress-related symptoms in human beings is just out of control. That there is so much ambient noise in this society and so much pressure and there's so much difficulty traveling, and then the television's trying to scare you, like the terrorists are all going to climb through our window and put poisonous gas in our bedroom, and we're going to get anthrax in the mail, and, you know, it's just one thing after another. We all know Bin Laden is out there creeping around somewhere. That, you know, there's so much emphasis on making people nervous. It seems like that many of the clients that I get are, you know, have so much stress-related illness that I think it's really important for people to relax as immediately as possible. And if using music helps them to do that, I'll use music. If smacking on the side of the head helps them, I would do it. But it doesn't seem to help anyone to relax, except every now and then.
I've also seen you work with people in developing artistic talents that they've always wished they had but never thought they could paint or draw.
Well, people's belief systems prevent them from trying so many things. I mean, you know, they draw a picture when they're in the third grade and somebody looks at them and goes, that's terrible. And suddenly they believe they have no talent. And you can't communicate with yourself unless you allow yourself to have the freedom of expression. It's one of the most important freedoms humans can have. You don't have to be selling your art for $1 million for it to be good for you to paint and to write poetry and to write short stories. And I mean, to me, if NLP it does anything, it should release the creativity in people in all fields. I've worked with lots and lots of athletes that have decided this is how good they are. And they believe that they're just going to stay that good and maybe get worse. That if you start to release the unconscious, line up unconscious processes and conscious processes, and expand that, you'd be surprised. Suddenly a baseball player can throw a pitch 5 miles an hour faster. They can catch balls they couldn't catch. They can whack balls, you know. It's an obsession in sports with balls. I'm not sure about that. But I worked with a golfer, and he absolutely believed he couldn't improve his game more than maybe a couple of strokes one way or the other. And that it was that he could be this good or worse. And when he'd go in, he would look at another player and go, you know, if I could only be like him, when instead of thinking, how can I be better than I am? And when a human being doesn't allow themselves any artistic expression, I think it kind of jams up a natural process. That, you know, you go out in the jungle in the middle of nowhere, you know, and there are natives out there painting on tree trunks with the, you know, herbs. And, you know, this compulsion in human beings to have expression, I think is an important thing. And in society, you know, everybody is so worried about what everybody else thinks of their things, they forget to think the most important thing is that you enjoy yourself and to expand yourself as a human being. And every time I've done things where I do a little thing on the stage where I install strategies from good artists inside of people, and suddenly, in a matter of moments, they're painting things that I think are wonderful. And they continue to get better and better. Because like everything else, including NLP, the more you do it, the better you should get at it. Because I believe people are either getting better or they're getting worse. And if you have to choose between the two, it seems like an obvious choice to me.
The other trainers that I'm going to be interviewing, I'm going to be asking them a question. If there's one particular phrase or line, either from a book or something that Richard said, that's really impacted them and kind of stayed with them. So necessarily can't ask you that question, but is there any one particular sort of gem or wisdom or little saying that you like that even for yourself is just poignant to keep in mind for those listening?
Yeah, Gregory Bateson one time. I was over Gregory Bateson's house, and there was another man there that was an intellectual, and he had read one of my books, and he said, I think that you're really naive, Richard, in your belief that everybody can get better. And I corrected him. I said, well, I believe everyone can get better except maybe you. And Gregory laughed, and he turned to the guy and he said, it's my belief, not Richard's belief, but Gregory's belief, you know, that the definition of intelligence is belief that we can all do better. And I thought that's a very simple statement, but a very profound one if you think about it. I mean, Gregory spent his whole life trying to analyze the way people communicated to help people out of what he considered to be double binds, you know, in your hospital when you won't accept that you're mentally disabled and psychologically impaired, they consider it part of your symptoms. When people go, I'm not crazy, and they go, aha, he's in denial. You know, that kind of a double bind instead of thinking, oh, he's getting better. He wants to be better. There's lots of ways of looking at the same thing. When Gregory said it, because my response was to want to take the guy outside and just beat the crap out of him. And Gregory, when he said that to him, the guy stopped and thought, well, I guess that means I'm not intelligent. And he said that to Gregory, and Gregory said, it's up to you. And I believe it's up to all of us to get better as human beings. Virginia once said to me also, she said, the strongest drive in human beings is to make things seem familiar, and that they'll die rather than face the unknown. And that really struck me as important, because most of my work is about making what's not familiar seem familiar, so that people look for new things rather than try to distort what they're presented. Because people are always raising their hand and going, isn't what you're saying the same as Sullivan's theory of blah, 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 blah? And my answer is always no. Because whenever I looked at what people did, I'm looking for what's different about it, so I have something new to add, rather than what makes it so I can go, oh, it's just to that, it's just to this, it's just to that. Every strategy I elicit, I look for how it can be used in a useful way. Even with schizophrenics, like the films of Andy. Here's a guy that, is locked away in a mental hospital because people come off the TV. And I started thinking what a great thing that would be if you were watching the right TV shows. I don't think he was schizophrenic. I just think he had bad taste. Watching Little House on the Prairie when you could be watching the Playboy Channel. I mean, come on, kid. He was locked in a hospital for 3 years. That's a bad choice. And then he pointed out to me, hospitals don't get the Playboy Channel. And I said, well, you're just going to have to get better and go somewhere else. To me, if he can hallucinate a person, he could hallucinate a pencil with an eraser and erase that person. And that kind of an attitude, I think, is really important. I think creative expression is part of how we talk to ourselves. Otherwise, all you do is listen to your internal voices and make pictures in your head. But once you get it out through your body, when you write some poetry and say it out loud, and when you draw paintings and look at them, you're looking at your unconscious, and it gives the unconscious processes, of which there are billions, operating all at the same time, a chance to reorganize themselves. Because when you're making art to make yourself feel good, you're lining yourself up. And I think that's an important phenomenon.
What advice would you give to someone who might be listening to this interview and making a decision about learning NLP? Or beginning to start as an NLP trainer, maybe?
Well, those are two different things to start with.
It's a two-part question.
Well, the first thing I would say is be very careful about who you train with. Mm-hmm. Find out what their training is, and notice how they treat you. Do they treat you as if they expect you to be better and help you to get better, or, are they, condescending? Because I find that people who are real condescending are not very helpful. And I would check to see how recently they've been trained and by whom, and find out what the who by whom thinks about them. This is why we maintain the society. Because just because somebody was good in 1970 doesn't mean they're any good now. If they haven't made their life better, odds are they can't make your life better. And, that as a technology, NLP is still in its youth as far as I'm concerned. I'm not done. I don't see how anybody else could be. And every year I develop new techniques and new technologies and find new ways of applying things. And I apply myself constantly. The doctor here just gave me a book on neurology, all the latest developments, and I incorporate everything. The new PET scans, I'm going through a lot of trouble to arrange to have access to a PET scan machine, because this will give us more detailed information about the human brain. If people are one-dimensional, if all they've ever been is an NLP trainer, then I don't see how they could have much experience. I still work as a scientist, and I still do lots of things. And the best people, I know your husband's the same way. He's got his fingers in everything. I mean, there's very little I can't talk to John about that he doesn't know something about. Eric is the same way, This guy hands me a neurology book. He knows who the author is. Because Eric is like me. We're consumers of knowledge. To me, one of the most important things you teach children is how to read. And you should make it so they really enjoy the process. One of the problems with school is we make it so we attach mathematics to unpleasantness and reading to unpleasantness. Reading, writing, and arithmetic. There are three R's. Excuse me, arithmetic isn't an R. It's an A. And it should be, it should be a wonderful thing. Math gives you the ability to to understand things in a different way. And instead of doing that, they make it so you just feel bad when you see numbers. And when and part of the thing is that the trainers should be well educated. They have an obligation to stay current. They should read the PDR and know what drugs are, not because we want to give them, but we should know what they do to our clients. We should know how the brain works. And people haven't really studied much about neurology. They're not really a neurolinguistic programming. If they don't know what the term thalamic intervention means, well, you know, it's not a therapeutic process. It's part of the think-a-do stuff that goes on in your head. You should know how the senses are hooked up. A couple nights ago, I worked with somebody who, quote, had hysterical blindness. It turned out they actually had been traumatized. They had a head injury, and it impaired their vision tremendously. But using hypnosis, at first they got back shapes and they could see, but they were having trouble seeing in black and white. That's all they could see. But yet, their internal images were in color. Now, that doesn't make a lot of sense if you think about it. The receptors in their eyes were fine. They hit their head, not their eyeballs. So the signals, it's just that the receptors weren't, the stimulation wasn't triggering the cortex. And so I got bright colored lights and shown dark green, and it said it's green. And had him take green in his head and put it on from the outside to the point where he could turn around and look at his wife. And at first her eyes were black and white. And then pretty soon he started to see the color. I had him go back and remember when he looked at her and the day they were married, and he was so much in love. And I said, could you see the picture in your head? And then I had him open his eyes and look at his wife so that he could use what he knew to make what he detects better. Because unless you can detect something with your senses, it's very hard to influence. This is, to me, the importance of people being able to pay attention to what they see and hear so much. You know, I mean, it's not enough to just say you need sensory acuity. You actually have to have it. If you don't hear what people say, it's very hard to use the way they think so that you can realize what's not there and add it. You know, kids who can't spell aren't stupid. They're not brain damaged. They just don't know they have to make pictures of the words and copy them down. When I pointed this out 35 years ago, it was a startling thing to teachers because they never thought about it. Phonics can't even be done phonetically. You know, that the phonetic system isn't phonetic by name. I mean, that's kind of incongruous if you think about it. They go, oh, well, a PH really is an F. No, it isn't. PH is a PH. And the fact that in English it sounds like an F really means you have to do it visually, not auditorily. And from that to the way they teach math and the way they teach history, they don't teach people how it applies to their life first. Later on, they'll give you a word problem. Like, you know, we all care about, you know, a train leaving Chicago at 200 miles an hour, one leaving Los Angeles at 120 miles an hour, making six stops for 5 minutes. When will the trains collide? I think the important part is they're on the same track and in the same direction. That's the first mistake. And that kind of a word problem doesn't really get it so that you know how to assign values to things. That when I took the few things that psychotherapists could do, built a calculus out of it, I could compute what else was there. So I actually can have ways of dealing with things that I've never seen before because the principles are applicable. Because I know I'm educating people. I'm not searching around in their childhood, coming up with an excuse for why they can't.
One of the favorite titles or phrases that we love to give you is the creative genius behind NLP, not just the founder and the developer. And I'd like to take this moment for thanking you for all the years that you've shared that creative genius with us and with NLP. And thank you also for taking the time to talk with us today. I hope lots of people listen and begin to share the experience of getting better. Thank you, Richard.
My pleasure.